Well, on Sunday mornings, we've been reading through the story of Daniel. Daniel, as you know, was a young Jewish man, a man who knew God, loved God, worshipped God. But along with three friends, Daniel was forced to go and live in the heathen city of Babylon. He was to be trained there to work for the king of Babylon. And we've seen how Daniel coped living in that ungodly, pagan environment. We've seen Daniel having dealings with three different kings. First, there was the king who took Daniel off to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, truly great king, man who turned Babylon into the greatest empire the world had ever seen. And then there was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, a much weaker and much more foolish man. And then we read about how Belshazzar was swept from the throne. An army of Medes and Persians attacked Babylon and killed Belshazzar, and Darius the Mede was installed as king in Babylon. And we've seen how Daniel got on under that third king, Darius. So you've got Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian, you've got Belshazzar, another Babylonian, and then you've got Darius, a king of the Medes and Persians, but ruling in Babylon. And Daniel had to live through the reigns of those three very different men. Now that's brought us to the end of chapter 6. We've had six chapters that basically take highlights from the story of Daniel as he and his friends faced those different kings. And at this point, the book changes. We're now going to have six more chapters that are rather different. Chapters 7 to 12 are not so much telling the story of Daniel. Instead, in these chapters, you've got some of the prophecies of Daniel. Chapters 1 to 6, the story of Daniel, and then chapters 7 to 12, the prophecies of Daniel. Now, what I want to do this morning is this. Since we've completed the first half of the book, I want us to look back. And I want us to try to pull out the main themes that we've had in those six chapters. We've had some very exciting stories. The three men in the burning fiery furnace. The writing on the wall. The story of Daniel in the lion's den. But what have been the big themes that have come through all those stories and everything else in the first six chapters? What's been the great central message of the first six chapters of this book of Daniel? Well, it's been about empires, states, governments, and the ways they act, and the claims that they make. What we've been seeing all the way through these chapters is how human states, human governments, set themselves up in the place of God. They start claiming supreme, unlimited power for themselves. They demand that people give them total, unquestioning obedience, the sort of obedience that should only be given to God himself. In fact, they demand that people worship them. You remember right back at the beginning of history, before the human race was divided into different nations, back then, human beings dreamed of becoming like God and making God himself redundant. You remember how they built a city and a tower, and they said, we can build this tower right up to heaven. We can take our place as gods in heaven. That was at the Tower of Babel. Well, their attempt failed. And those people were scattered in all directions, and they became divided into different nations. But from there on, different rulers have tried the same thing again and again. Each one has said the same thing: I'm going to reunite the human race. I'm going to build a giant empire encompassing the world. And then under my leadership, man is going to overcome all his limitations. We're going to reach heaven yet. We're going to become like gods. Then we won't need any other god. That's been the dream of countless empire builders down through the centuries. And you can see that in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In chapter 2, what does Nebuchadnezzar dream of? He dreams about the human race becoming all-powerful, dazzling, glorious, magnificent. That's what it means when he dreams about the human race and sees it as a vast statue towering right up into the sky. You can see in chapter 3 how Nebuchadnezzar thinks of himself and his empire. He actually does set up as a giant statue. A statue of himself and his empire. It's a symbol of his empire. And then he demands that everyone in the empire should worship the statue, his own image. And when Daniel's three friends refuse to worship it, they're thrown into the incinerator. As far as Nebuchadnezzar is concerned, anyone who refuses to worship him and his empire, his state, such a person deserves to be incinerated. You see it again in chapter 4 when Nebuchadnezzar dreams another dream. This time he sees himself as a giant tree. And we're told in his dream the tree grew and became strong and its top reached to heaven. That's the way Nebuchadnezzar thought of himself. He could bridge the gap between earth and heaven, and all the people of the world would find their needs met under his shade. He would be their God. That's what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of being, a God for all the people of his empire. And then you move on to chapter 5, and you see Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, the last Babylonian king, Belshazzar. Well, what's Belshazzar's greatest crime? He takes the holy vessels which his grandfather had brought from Jerusalem, cups that were to be used only for the worship of God, and he uses them himself. He uses them for his own drunken feasting. He's saying, I'm a god myself. I've got the right to use these cups. If these cups are for God, then that means they're for me, says Belshazzar. Now, Belshazzar's way of boasting that he's a god is very different from Nebuchadnezzar's way. Belshazzar, as we said, is a drunken playboy, while Nebuchadnezzar was a great statesman, a great architect. Nebuchadnezzar sets out to prove that he's a god by building the greatest buildings the world's ever seen. Builds hanging gardens that are like the Garden of Eden restored. In that way he can say, I'm worthy to be worshipped as God. Well, Belshazzar sets out to prove he's a god by getting drunk using the drinking vessels that belong to God, and then defying God to do something about it. But they've both got the same idea in their heads. In their different, very different ways, they're both saying, I'm more than a man, you know. I'm Superman. I'm divine. And then, of course, you see it in the chapter that we read last week, chapter 6, where King Darius passes a law that no one should pray to any god for the next 30 days. They must pray to him. Now, he didn't realize that Daniel was going to be trapped by that law, but he certainly realized what the law meant. He realized that he was setting himself up as a god, And he didn't think there was anything wrong or blasphemous about passing a law like that. He thought it was perfectly reasonable that people should treat him like a god and that people should pray to him. You see, it's there in chapter after chapter. Human beings, human rulers, putting themselves in the place of God, promising that under their control, the human race can become divine. In their different ways, all these three kings are examples of that. And I've given you, as we've gone through, lots of other examples, haven't I? Of other rulers, other governments in more modern times, saying the same things, making the same claims. The Nazi regime in Germany. Talked about Kim Il-sung in North Korea, didn't we? We don't need to go that far. We could talk about things much closer to home. Here, you know, in the Western world, here in Great Britain, we've got a government that says, we're going to reshape human beings. We can reshape the very stuff of human life. We're going to create animal-human hybrid embryos. We can create, or we can destroy, as we think fit. And you've got to trust us, says the government. And if you do, if you trust us, then we'll eliminate disease and disability. And ultimately our goal is to eliminate death itself. We can create a world free from disease, free from poverty, free from conflict, free from death. Because we've got the power now. We've got the power now to manipulate the very stuff of life. What are they saying? They're saying, we are your new gods. Trust us. Worship us. And you'll become gods with us. They're promising that the human race can escape from all its limitations. They're promising just what the people at the Tower of Babel promised. With our new technology, we can reach heaven. That's what the first six chapters of Daniel have all been about. Human governments, the state, putting itself in the place of God. But then, of course, there's been another message running through these chapters as well. And it's a very simple one. These chapters tell us that all these attempts by different rulers, by different governments to put themselves in God's place, all these attempts fail. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar may dream of humanity becoming dazzling, golden, godlike, under his leadership. But as the dream goes on, it becomes obvious that it's not going to happen. You remember the golden head of the statue gives way to silver shoulders, and then to a bronze torso, and finally to legs and feet of iron mixed with clay. He's not going to be able to build a golden empire that will last forever. Soon, his own reign is going to come to an end. And then other feebler men will take his place. And finally the whole thing is going to be broken into smithereens. Because however impressive it looks, it's all fragile. In chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar demands that everyone in the empire should worship his statue or be incinerated. But in the end, he's left humiliated. Because he simply can't make Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego worship him. There's a limit to the power of the king. He can threaten, he can bully, but in the end he can't bend the wills of God's people. And when he tries to execute these three men, they won't burn. Because God himself, the Son of God, comes down and walks with them in the furnace and shields them. So the king who sets himself up as God is publicly exposed as powerless. He can't force the three and he can't burn the three. The men who live by faith in God are immortal and the king is powerless to kill them. Chapter 4, you've got the dream of the tree. Nebuchadnezzar's going to be a tree touching heaven. No, you're not, says God. You're going to be cut down. And he is. Even as he's boasting about his great achievements, isn't this great Babylon that I have made for the display of my glory? Even while he's boasting of his godlike power, what does God do? God takes away his sanity. And he starts behaving like an animal. Finishes up living in the fields, eating grass like a cow. That's it. He dreamed of being God. He claimed to be God. He set himself up as God. He built this whole city in order to shout to everybody that he's God. And he finishes up outside the city in the fields like an animal crawling around. People, rulers, states, societies which dream of being superhuman finish up being subhuman. Societies which say that we can make God redundant become bestial societies. They disintegrate into insanity and chaos. It's there in chapter 5. Belshazzar laughs at God as he pours down the wine from those sacred cups. I'm as much a god as you are. You can't touch me. And that very night God sweeps him from power. And Belshazzar's life is cut short along with the life of the Empire of Babylon. And of course it's there in chapter 6. Daniel is going to carry on praying to the God of heaven, though he's forbidden to by the king's decree. And Daniel's thrown into the den of lions in accordance with the king's decree. But again, how much is the king's decree actually worth? They discover that Daniel is immortal. Daniel is indestructible. Because the angel of the Lord is with him there in that den. And it's the men who pushed the king into such a wicked decree. The men who flattered the king and told him that he was a god. And that he was worthy to have everybody praying to him. It was those men and their families who finished up being torn apart by the lions in the den. Do you see what you've got illustrated across these chapters is simply this, that every attempt by a human ruler, a state, a society, every attempt to defy God and make God redundant ends in failure one way or another. In each of these chapters, God asserts himself and makes all the claims of human beings to be divine look silly. God confronts the people who say that they can be gods themselves, and God humbles them. In the case of Nebuchadnezzar, he accepts the humbling. And he says, I'm not a god. I know now that there's only one God, and he's the God of heaven. In the case of Belshazzar, he refuses the humbling. And he dies under the judgment of God. But all the way through, you've got God confronting people, giving them graphic demonstrations, graphic proofs that they're not gods themselves, that they're not almighty, whatever they claim, that they're not worthy to be worshipped, that they're powerless in his face. That's the message we're to learn from these chapters. And it's the message we learn from countless chapters of history. You know, the German people back in the 1930s gave their total allegiance to a ruler who promised to make them into a nation of gods. And they worshipped that ruler as God. And where did his dream and where did their dreams end? They watched their God descend into insanity. Saw him raging and deluded, ordering around imaginary armies and finally killing himself. And the nation that believed his promises, he promised them a 1,000-year Reich. That nation found itself starving, scrabbling for existence in the rubble of its ruined cities. God humbles the proud. And maybe God is humbling this arrogant nation in which we live. You know, people look at the chaos, the crime, the drunkenness, the mental illness, the feral youth, the teenage pregnancies, the child abuse, the rioting football fans. And they ask, what's happening? What's happening? They've believed a whole string of governments that have promised them that everything's going to get better step by step. Well, it's the book of Daniel that gives the answer, what's happening? When people try to make God redundant, then God asserts himself in one way or another. And maybe that's the way that God is asserting himself in our society. He's not sending earthquakes every week. He's not causing us to be invaded by foreign invaders. But he is handing us over to disintegration, to moral chaos. It's the Romans 1 way. And Paul talks in Romans 1 how God deals with a society that deliberately suppresses the truth about him. And Paul says God hands them over. He says he hands them over to sexual chaos, to an anything goes morality or amorality, where the structure of all relationships just disintegrates. He hands them over to impurity. He hands them over to practices that leave them defiled and wretched. Paul says he hands them over to ever more unnatural and perverted practices. And then Paul says he hands them over to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They become gossips and slanderers and God-haters and insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. They do these things and they approve and applaud those who practice these things. Now, isn't that a description of what's happening in our society? God is doing just what he said he would do. You know, sometimes I hear Christians saying, oh, our society's in such a mess. Why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't God intervene? Well, God is doing something. He's doing exactly what he said he would do. He's handing our society over to this moral crisis, which gets deeper and deeper. What we see around us is not God doing nothing. We're seeing God intervening in exactly the way he said he would intervene. You know, several times in this series I've quoted to you the words spoken by one of the Reith lecturers 40 years ago. He said, men have become like gods. Isn't it time to recognize our divinity? And that's been the philosophy that's motivated the ruling elite in our country for a generation. That we are gods ruling over godlets. Well, then it's no wonder, is it, that God has asserted himself. And the way he's done it is by handing those people who claim to be gods, handing them over to become beasts. It's his exposure of the lie that men can turn themselves into gods. It's so humiliating for these politicians who have swanned around with their air of all competence, making their great predictions and promises. It's humiliating for them to be forced to admit that they've got no answers whatsoever, to see the country coming apart at the seams, to see the sort of scenes that happened in Manchester midweek with those rioting football fans, and the politicians say, we can't do anything. But that is God. That is God stripping away the illusion that men can be gods and can build their perfect society. It's God asserting himself. As you read through the first six chapters of Daniel, you see God asserting himself in all sorts of ways. We've got to recognize the way that God is asserting himself in our society, in our time. So you've got two big themes in Daniel 1 to 6. First, the way that human beings, states, governments, try to put themselves into God's place. Try to, or claim they can build a perfect society. And then secondly, the way that God intervenes again and again to frustrate them, to block, to humiliate those arrogant dreams. And then there's a third theme. And it's this. The fact that God has promised that in the end he will sweep aside the governments that men set up for themselves. He'll sweep aside all the societies that they build. And he'll set up his own kingdom. He'll set up his empire. A society that will truly be perfect and that will last forever. Of the chapters we've looked at so far, it's in chapter 2, isn't it, that comes out most clearly. Nebuchadnezzar's great dream. And as we've said, in that dream he sees all the great empires of the world, from his own time through to the end of history. And he sees them like one giant statue made for the glory of man. His own empire is like the golden head of the statue. And then the empire of the Medes and Persians will be like the silver arms and shoulders of the statue. And then the empire of the Greeks will be like the bronze torso of the statue. And then the empire of Rome, the empire of the Western world, the empire we're living in now, will be like the legs of iron balanced on feet of iron mixed with clay. There it stands. This huge, imposing symbol of human greatness. Human society as it's developed down through the millennia. But then Nebuchadnezzar in his dream sees a stone cut out. And it's not cut out by human hands. What's going to happen is not going to happen by human effort or brilliance or power. He sees a stone cut out. And the stone is rolled towards the statue. And it strikes the statue on its feet. And the feet break up. And then the whole statue disintegrates. It's smashed into dust. And the wind carries the dust away. And the stone grows to fill the whole earth. And it leaves no room for anything else. And you remember what that statue represents. What that stone represents. It represents the kingdom of God. Smashing to bits all the empires, all the governments of men, taking their place, standing forever. In the end, there will only be one government, one king, one empire. Sang with the kids last night in our home, "So be it, Lord. Thy throne shall never, like earth's proud empires, pass away. Thy kingdom stands and grows forever, till all thy creatures own thy sway." So there you've got the reminder of what we've dealt with so far. The big themes in the first six chapters of the book of Daniel. Man's attempts to set himself up and put himself in the place of God. God's constant interventions to frustrate man's attempts. And then the promise that at the end there will be one last great decisive intervention and God will sweep away the whole human enterprise. All the attempts of men to build empires for themselves will all be swept away. And the one eternal kingdom, the kingdom of God, will be established to fill the whole earth. Now those are the themes then that are going to be worked out in much more detail in the remaining six chapters. In the prophecies of Daniel, chapters 7 to 12. We read together through the first half of Daniel chapter 7 and in weeks to come. I want us to go through that chapter in detail. But even just reading through a few minutes ago, then surely we saw those great themes so powerfully in chapter 7. What's chapter 7 about? It's about a dream that Daniel had. In the first half of the book, Daniel was explaining other people's dreams. But now, he tells us about the dreams and visions that God gave him. And in Daniel's vision in chapter 7, he sees just the same four empires that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his. But Daniel sees them very differently from the way that Nebuchadnezzar saw them. Nebuchadnezzar saw the four empires as making up one beautiful, dazzling, godlike figure. Daniel sees them as four monstrous animals. You see, it's that big theme coming through again. Human rulers think of themselves as godlike, and they think they can build societies where man becomes his own god. But in fact, they become beasts, they become monsters, and the societies they build become monstrous and bestial and horrible. So where Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of a superman, Daniel dreams of monsters. And in Daniel's dream, it's the fourth beast, the last empire, that's the most monstrous of them all. And from that fourth empire comes a horrible, evil figure. He's described as a horn growing on the beast. And this horn's got a mouth. And he speaks blasphemous things against God. And he persecutes God's people. So from that last horrible, monstrous empire comes an individual figure who more than anybody before him sets himself up to attack God and to put himself in the place of God. And it says this, that he wears out God's people. He grinds them down. He makes them feel that their misery is never going to end. This monstrous figure is determined to crush God's people underfoot. And there are times when they feel, yes, that he is grinding the life out of them. But then, in Daniel's dream, Daniel sees the final great intervention. This is what he sees. He sees the Ancient of Days. He sees the Eternal God taking his proper place as king and judge. As I looked, thrones were set in place. Up till now, men had put their own thrones in place. But now, God is putting thrones in place for those who are worthy to sit on them. Thrones were set in place. And the Ancient of Days, the Eternal One, the Lord, he who is, the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. Oh, the grimy records of human rulers. But when the Eternal One takes his place on the throne, everything about him is dazzling in purity. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze, and a river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. And thousands upon thousands of holy beings attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, and the courts were seated, and the books were opened. And then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. And I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. You see, the powers of evil, brutal governments, persecuting states will not be allowed to grind down God's people forever. God is going to intervene. And the last bestial subhuman empire is going to be burned up forever by the fire that flows from the throne of God. And then at last, God is going to lead forward his true king, the king whom God has chosen to rule over the kingdom that he's setting up. Listen again to what Daniel says. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. And he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence, and he was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. And all peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The time comes for all the governments that men have set up to be swept away, to be cast into the fire. The time comes for God's everlasting kingdom to fill the whole earth. But who is going to rule over this everlasting kingdom? And that's where the surprise comes. Daniel says, I saw a man. I saw one like a son of man, being led into the presence of the Ancient of Days. He comes on the clouds of heaven, and to him is given authority, glory, and sovereign power. At last, a man is found who is worthy to sit on the throne and to be worshipped as God, to be worshipped alongside the Ancient of Days. Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, they all claimed to be gods. They all said that they had almighty power. They all said that they were worthy to be worshipped. But they finished up as beasts. But here at last, there's a man, a real man, the Son of Man, who is worthy to sit alongside God, who's worthy to sit on the throne of the universe, who's worthy to be worshipped. God gives him authority, glory, and sovereign power. All the other rulers and emperors of history have demanded glory for themselves and claimed it and grabbed it. But here is one to whom God the Father says, I give you glory. I give you sovereign power. You deserve it. You're worthy of it. Here at last is a man, the Son of Man, who is worthy to sit alongside God on the throne of the universe, who's worthy to be worshipped by peoples, nations, and men of every language. Think about all the millennia, the thousands of years of human history, and the kingdoms and the empires that have come and gone, all the different men who have set themselves up, who have claimed to be something, who have sought glory for themselves. One after another, they've been swept away. None of them has managed to build a kingdom that would last. None of them has found to be worthy. Somewhere in all of them, there's been a beast. Not one of them you could say, yes, he's a true man. He's what a human being is supposed to be. He's a man in the image of God. But now at last, a man is found who is a real man, in whom there's no trace of being a beast. Here at last you've got a man who is the perfect image of God, and who is fit to share the glory of God, who is fit to sit on the throne and to be worshipped. Who is this man? Who is the one man who is going to come on the clouds and sit at God's right hand forever and reign as king? Who is worthy? Do you remember the question that the high priest put to the Lord Jesus at his trial? You'll find the question and the answer recorded in Matthew 14, verse 61. The high priest asks him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." There's only one candidate. There's only one man who will ever approach the Ancient of Days and be led into his presence and be given authority, glory, and sovereign power. There's only one man who's worthy to build the empire that will encompass all the earth and will last forever. There's only one man who's worthy to be worshipped. That is the Lord Jesus. You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. What have we gained by working through the first six chapters of Daniel? Well, I hope that we've learned to understand something of the world we live in. I hope that with these chapters in our minds, we can recognize more clearly just what is happening in the world and in our country. What lies behind all the strange things that governments are doing? You know, we talk sometimes about connected or joined up government. And at times it doesn't seem like that. At times it, when you look at all the contradictory things that a government tries to do, you think, is there any connecting thread in all their policy? Well, the connecting thread is here. The connecting thread is that they want to turn themselves into gods. They want to make God redundant. They want to build a perfect society without God. I hope we can recognize more clearly just what is happening in the world around us. And I hope that after looking at these six chapters, I hope we can see more clearly God's hand in the world today. That we can recognize the ways in which God is reacting to human rebellion and to arrogance. You know, it should encourage us. If we can see that God is doing just the things he said he would do in a world where people are trying to sideline him, that should be a great encouragement to us. When we look around at all the confusing, catastrophic things that are happening in the world, they make sense. Because God is doing just what he said he would do. But most of all, after working through these first six chapters of Daniel, most of all I hope that we look forward. That we look forward with more certainty and more eagerness to the day when all the empires of sinful men are finally swept away. Are you sick of this world? There are times when I feel utterly sick of this world. I feel sick of having to live in a world dominated by arrogant, deceitful rulers. In a world where people all the time, politicians, are demanding that you trust them while they're lying through their teeth. There are times when I get so sick of living in this world with its corruption and its twistedness and its lies, but above all, the arrogance of men who claim that they can build the perfect world where they can't even run their own marriages properly. Well, it's not always going to be like this. We're not always going to be ruled over by beasts. Jesus Christ is coming again. He's coming again on the clouds of heaven. And if you belong to Jesus Christ, you're going to live in a world where Jesus Christ reigns. You're going to live in a world of justice and truth and peace and freedom. You're going to live in a world where everything is whiter than white. And most of all, you're going to live in a world ruled by love. You know, I have to say that not all politicians are equally vile. I might say about some world rulers, well, at least he's effective. Well, at least he has some good ideas. At least he tells the truth some of the time. But where is the politician, the ruler, of whom you would say, he loves us? He would lay down his life for us. Well, if you belong to Christ, you're looking forward to a kingdom ruled over by a king who loves us and who did lay down his life for us. And that's why we say that Jesus Christ is worthy to receive authority, glory, and sovereign power.